Hey, Bill and Gunnan, welcome to Black Belt Tribal Edition for, I think it's probably one of the last programs for the year. That is 2024, if you're listening. And, well, I hope you're doing well wherever you are joining us today. And we are happy to give you some information about what sovereignty is and also, I guess, what the latest is in the world of Indigenous affairs, whether it's outside or inside of Australia. And joining me today is Ganyara and Nyirilam. Bumi was supposed to come in today, but I think he might come in later on. Let's see what happens here. But first of all, it's not the first time we've covered this particular story, but given the nature of the relevance that Jacinta Price has come out saying that Welcome to Countries again isn't traditionally, let's say, cultural application in the way it is now, which, I mean, you can argue about that about anything, really. But let's take a listen to what she says here on Sky News earlier this week.
An Indigenous community in Queensland has banned Welcome to Country ceremonies, claiming they are embarrassing and being abused. The Juru people of the Burdekin said the elders have had enough with the commercialisation of it. Joining us now from Alice Springs is the Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians, Jacinta Nampajimba-Price. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. If an Indigenous group has said, well, enough is enough with this, what does it say about those who continue then to perform this ceremony at every event and occasion?
Well, Danica, you know, we all know that it's become... we have an Aboriginal industry that's currently set up in our country, and the whole Welcome to Country ceremony has just broadened that industry, if you like, and there are those right around the country whose basically their only role, their only source of income is delivering Welcome to Country. And, you know, to say that it's traditional culture, well, we didn't sort of have business transactions traditionally. Those business transactions didn't necessarily exist in that way, where you offered a Welcome to Country and then were paid given some form of payment in return. And again, this commercialisation of culture, which is exactly what is going on, I can understand there'll be those that will be upset if we try to bring it to an end. But I think there are other ways that we can encourage people to take up employment or take up opportunities in terms of money. But I think you know, this is demonstrating that I think everyone's getting sick of Welcome to Country, the Indigenous groups and the broader community.
Senator Price, you have hit on something absolutely magnificent. Next time an Indigenous group says it's cultural, we want to perform a Welcome to Country, the response should be, we want to honour the culture, so we're not going to give you any money, and it could be as it originally was. I want to get your thoughts on the Queensland State Government's decision to repeal Labor's Path to Treaty Act, which effectively scrapped the Truth Telling and Healing Inquiry 5 months after it began. What's left of the $300 million that's been allocated towards the Path to Treaty has been reallocated towards Indigenous health, housing, education. Now, as people would imagine, there's been the outrage from activists on the ground. I'm wondering if Indigenous people are feeling the same outrage, or maybe there's not that much angst about it from the everyday Indigenous folk who aren't involved in the, you know, the whole industry that so often accompanies Indigenous affairs.
Yeah, look, I mean, I want to congratulate Chris Afulli and his government for taking this decision to put that funding toward trying to, you know, gain practical outcomes for marginalised Indigenous Australians, because the whole treaty process, I believe, is a real, once again, I think, a more sort of top-down approach. It's more of an elitist approach. If we look at New Zealand, nothing much has come about for the Māori as a result of the Waitangi Treaty. The Waitangi Tribunal has become highly politicised in pushing, you know, to block development. When I was over in New Zealand speaking to some of the members of New Zealand First, I'd been informed that... you know, there's a lot going on in terms of blocking development for, you know, Māori people using their land. It's very similar to what's going on here, but everything is politicised. The treaty process has been politicised over there. No doubt that's what's been going on here in Australia. That money is much better being spent to produce practical outcomes on the ground for those who need it right now, living in a crisis situation, as opposed to developing treaties where we don't know, you know, the extent of that process. We don't know who is actually going to gain anything from that. And besides, you don't have treaties with one's own citizens anyway. We're Australian citizens. We've got to get past that point and start treating Australians along those lines, on the basis of need, not race.
And this is a thing, Senator, because even in South Australia, only last week, I think it was the week before, they had their first address in Parliament for the South Australian Voice. And we know that 60% of Australians voted no to the Voice. What is actually going to satisfy these groups? Because they're forging their own pathways here. They're going against the Australian public. What is going to satisfy them?
Look, I don't know. I mean, ever since this industry was built, it's sort of an ever-evolving thing. I mean, Labor is so good at wanting to set up token commissioners, token organisations. The Voice was going to be another one of those token mechanisms. I mean, you know, the reason why my mother got into Parliament in the first place was because she was chair of the Indigenous Advisory for the then Henderson government and thought, they're not actually interested, really, in what Aboriginal people have to say. They'll set up these token bodies and they'll pretend, they'll act as though they're doing something right for Indigenous Australians. And that's exactly what's going on in South Australia at the moment. I mean, it's a shambles. A number of those elected members of their Voice have since resigned from their positions. I don't know whether they've held another election to put up more members. There was only a 10% voter turnout in the first place. It's just an absolute shambles, and what it's supposed to achieve, I don't know. Maybe it's a handball for the South Australian government. Anything Indigenous, oh, let's give it to the Voice and let them deal with it. We're not actually going to deal with it. Let's give it to them because it's too hardball. It's just nonsense, and, you know, time will tell. And again, I think the Australian people say, well, look, we told you so. Let's move forward now as one country.
There you go. Gunyara, I guess, obviously, she's a little bit right to the centre of politics, if you could say that. Nevertheless, she is the shadow Indigenous Australians minister in the federal level. Does she have a leg to stand on in terms of her position?
Let me ask you this. Are the Australians really welcome? You know, this is just cutting through all the crap, you know. They come in, they took over the place, they settled in the house without, you know, asking per se. They didn't get permission to settle in the house. Then they took over the house. So are they really welcome? So, look, it is being commercialised. When you've got to pay someone to welcome you to country, the opposite is really the truth of the matter. Are you really welcome? Unless you give us money, we're not welcome type stuff. You know, that's not, you know, so it really is wrong. But the alternative to that, of not being welcome, is when someone intruded upon your territory, it was nearly an act of war, declaration of war on the nation, and do the nations want to go to war with Australia, for example, take out the spears, back to that again, which is what happened when another nation come in without consent. You know, the Yidinji mob, for example, they had a cockatoo feather. So when someone come into Yidinji territory, they went and got a white cockatoo feather, sent the runner into where the main camp was, where the main township was, and said, okay, we've got our mob sitting outside of town here. Are we welcome to come into your country? This is real welcome to country. And I don't see any cockatoo feathers being used at these welcome to country ceremonies. I don't see the Australians, like the Australian government, for example, bringing a white cockatoo feather to the meeting and saying, are we welcome, yes or no? And if they are welcome, you don't need to pay for it. You definitely don't need to pay, but we're in a commercial world now, and that's all it is. This is all just about commerce. How do the Aboriginal people survive in a nation that's had this commercial thing imposed upon them? It is through the money. So there is yes and no. The Aboriginal people do need the money because they've been deprived of everything, all their resources, but they shouldn't be doing it that way where we've got to be paid to give a welcome.
Yeah, I think the very nature of this transactional world we live in, where it's very, very shallow at times or without any type of emotion attached to it. This is the thing that I think maybe yet what she's at the core of what she's trying to portray here. But Yiralem, it's just, you know, if you're part of that world and it's transactional, then if she's even being paid as a senator to do a job, it's sort of the same thing, really, whether you're doing a welcome or a public service.
Yeah, very much so. You know, look at the way that you introduced her just then, yeah, the Shadow Minister for Indigenous Australians. You know, well, that sort of is the whole crux of a lot of the discussions we have on air, is the difference between an Indigenous Australian and a traditional owner on their own land under their own law. You know, so it really does go down that path of, well, you know, are you really representing the true nations, the original nations of this country, the first ones? You know, I find it quite amusing that I've heard so many different variations of welcome to countries versus acknowledgement of country. And, you know, for me, the only real one that says it all is if, you know, the past, present and future, if you're referring to the owners of the past, the present and the future are the original people of this country, not the ones who turned up here 100 or so years ago.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, for the Yidinji Nation, let's say, creating that mechanism is the government and the treaty, so you don't have to do welcomes or acknowledgements. It's just normal business, and part of that world of contract law is this is a very much part of it, Gagnara.
Look, you mentioned the word treaty amongst that, and that's all a treaty is—just contract. It's contractual arrangement. But I see, you know, Queensland recently has basically scrapped the treaty process. Well, guess what? It's a good thing, because the state of Queensland is not sovereign enough to represent all Australians at a treaty level agreement or contract. That's the role of the Commonwealth of Australia. So, you know, that was the best thing they'd done. I think they said they'd allocated $300 million to something like that. Now they're going to use it for Indigenous health. That's what should happen with The Voice as well, by the way. Well, I think it was said on air a few times that the money that was allocated to The Voice should have been given to the Indigenous Australians, and I'll use the Indigenous Australians, as Yiralem just said, to, you know, for healthcare, for school, for education and that. Do the right thing by it, because The Voice was a dead failure simply because they were talking about Indigenous Australians. Just as now we're talking about Aboriginal Queenslanders in a treaty, they have no right to negotiate. It's all about identity. They have no right to negotiate about a treaty. Queensland doesn't have the right to negotiate a treaty, and they're not treaties, as it was clearly stated, what, 8-9 years ago, was said that they are not treaties in the true sense of the word. So we're going to waste $300 million. Now they've saved it, so that's a good thing on that account there. But it is all about legal identity. The whole lot of contract law is all about identity.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very important. It would be interesting to see what Senator Price thinks about direct funding models. So, like, for example, rather than the federal money going through the states and the states take 30% of administration fees, how about the states miss out and it goes directly to the Aboriginal organisations and the communities that are doing all the work? So, you know, I don't think she'd be very popular if she supported that, or maybe she does, I'm not sure. But once again, we're outside of that box. But there's all those types of potentials inside of Australia. But this is the thing that keeps perpetuating the same problems, Yiralem, is that that lack of, because it's so many competing interests in there, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander interests or Indigenous interests are sort of relegated to the bottom of it.
Well, honestly, it always will be, and it will continue in that circular motion of the same old stuff going round and round while there is no separate identity. Like you both pointed out, there can't be a treaty unless there is two parties involved. And an Indigenous Australian cannot make a treaty with a non-Indigenous Australian because they're all Australians. It's all the same identities. They're coming from the same place. You can't marry yourself, so in this case, this process will continue where it's not treated as anything special because they really don't want to see that separation happen where the other identities come into being.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most frequently broadcast issues on this program is about identity. Every Indigenous nation has the right to create its own identity, not rely on the Australian one 100% of the time. For example, the former Minister for Indigenous Australia, Linda Burney, admitted to National Indigenous Radio Service a few years ago now, where the Australian citizenship was conferred on Aboriginal people, Ganyara, and that has a huge meaning, or maybe there's a lack of understanding to what that actually meant to the people that are using the Australian ID.
What people don't understand is conferral is a gift. We'll gift you this if you want to use it. But why would they write UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, which is what we were just talking about earlier in the day, about why would they write this document where it says the Aboriginal people can work out how they identify themselves, how, you know, what are they? Are they in it, you know, work out your identity, work out your government, work out all the institutions. Why would they write that? Back in 2007 it was accepted. Australia accepted it in 2009, you know, which, by gee, it was 15 years ago. You know, 1.5 decades ago, Australia accepted that, and we're doing this. We've been doing it for a while now, and people are only just slowly catching up to it now. We were told that the state-based treaty was just a can-kicking exercise. They're going to push it down the road as far as they can till it runs out. Now it's running out in Queensland, but they did acknowledge in the legislation that UNDRIP has teeth. It's real. It is legitimate. If you go and read the Tracts to Treaty or the Part to Treaty legislation, it actually says that they use UNDRIP as a base model, you know. So we've got to accept it for what it is. And it is about identity. It's all about us and them. By the way, you know, you look back at the voice stuff and the constitutional recognition, Australia had handpicked some of the best constitutional experts they had, including the likes of Mark Liebler and Natasha Stott-Despoyer and I think Amanda Vanstone. There's quite a number of people on there. I think there was 12 or 13 people that went forward. And they are the ones that come back, by the way, and said coexisting sovereignties, not us. They said it. These were the experts handpicked by Turnbull at the time, the Prime Minister, and Shorten, the leader of the opposition, had agreed that these are the best. And they come back and said that this is for real, coexisting sovereignty, not us. So if there's coexisting sovereignty, how can Indigenous Australians be in one sovereignty yet be in the other? They can't. You're either in this sovereignty where your identity is created. We're just humans. Like we said a few shows ago there about King Charles. That bloke, Charlie, nice old bloke, has multiple legal identities that he can be seen through. Just as our Yidinji people, men and women, can be seen through the Australian identity or seen through the Yidinji identity and the coexisting sovereignties. So the men and women aren't the identities, but they're the user of identity, and this is how you participate in a society.
It's interesting you brought that up with the king. So his identity in pick a country where he's got a different identity for him. Where's another country besides England?
Well, Jamaica.
Jamaica. Like
so in Jamaica, they may have different pedestrian road rules, and he might walk across the road and get booked for it. Whereas in England, he wouldn't. So what's happened with that identity is he's chosen a different jurisdiction.
Absolutely. Look, the important part is that it's the laws of the jurisdiction as to where the legal identity is created. You know, as in Australia, we have Indigenous Australians who have the right or who have the ability to be seen inside another jurisdiction of coexisting sovereignty. The problem is, there's no formal agreement between the coexisting sovereignties. Is that what we're talking about?
Absolutely. And, yeah, that's the beauty of it here that Yidinji has done, and every other nation, you know, from that has been on this continent for tens and hundreds of thousands of years, depending on which scientist you're listening to.
Millions.
Millions. Thank you for that.
Dr. Murray.
Yeah. Saint Murray.
Thank you.
Depending on, so you made me lose track now. I don't want to talk about it now and again. Is the opportunity on this continent anyway to choose and have your own jurisdiction? Yeah, how special is Yidinji to be able to do that? That we've got our own jurisdiction that's separate to Australia. So even though I find that the jurisdiction here is actually more severe for doing the wrong thing, I'm not going to do the wrong thing, so I'm not really worried about that. You know, what it's about is the fact that you can choose. Now, one thing I do know, that my closest friends will not be discriminated against here. So this is why I choose this jurisdiction to be the one under.
Yeah, and, you know, each jurisdiction has its benefits. For example, some of the weird laws in Britain is that you can't kill swans or dolphins because they're the property of the royal family or the king. You can't wear you know, those knights in shining armour. You can't wear your armour into the parliament because it's treason and there's all this kind of stuff. These are ancient laws that are still there today, like ancient laws here in Yidinji, which is tribal law, but we don't mix with that here. The same way that Charles doesn't go into parliament too often as his tribal persona, he wears the hat, the identity, as the king of England or the UK or whatever it may be in the other realms. So it's knowing how to act and when to act if you imagine your Wesley Snipes, you're going to act as one of the movies that he's in. The vampire one. He can't act as the vampire one as Blade in Waiting to Exhale, the love story of those girls. You know, so you've got to know how to act.
The key point that you've just brought up is the fact that there's a choice. The king can choose, the Wesley Snipes can choose if he's acting. In Australia, Indigenous people have not had a choice. They've only been given one. What was the word? Conferred. They were conferred identities, and that means it doesn't just mean you get a license with your name on it. It means that you come under the law of Australia, which was created by. Can you correct me? Was there some sort of policy? Who were they created by? And you know, it's. The difference is that Yidinji is the first one to step up with a different identity. So now we can choose to not be Australian.
It's the movie. We're the directors of the movie. We're the ones who are finding it. Whereas in Australia, an Indigenous Australian is Kamal. Kamal, famously, the Sri Lankan singer, who's an Australian, played an Aboriginal man shaking a spear and doing stuff on screen. This is how it works there. The same way that... In the movies, you can have these heroes, but usually, apart from Jeddah and a few others now, it's not Aboriginal people. They're sort of in the background, doing whatever, looking deadly or not looking deadly.
Yeah, look, it's at least I suppose Kamal didn't have to use blackface, you know, a bit of boot polish or whatever. You know where they used to take the Mickey out of the Murray poor buggers. But look, you are right. It's crazy as it is. But you were just talking about ancient old legislation. Believe it or not, in Queensland, we've got some real. There is some real legacy legislation that goes back to the 1600s from the UK.
Oh wow!
It really is, and there's quite a number of acts that are still there from the old days, which really says to me, Queensland is nothing more than a manifestation of colonialism, and nor is Australia the same thing. You know, it's nothing better than that. So why do we want to be part of that? We need to be where we rightfully belong, under the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, doing our thing, creating our identity. We've got every right to do it, and we've got every right now to be recognised in the international world exactly what is going on as to our identity and everything else.
Yeah, I think it's also important to reiterate that the sovereign Yidinji government is not tribal law. It is law that is codified, that's written down. So every other man, woman on this planet who's not used to tribal law can look at Yidinji and saying, oh, you've got some written laws to help me understand who you are, what I can do on your territory, what I can't do, and how to go about business and maybe live there in harmony with other men and women that call that place home.
Precisely what we've got to do. And this is to try and prevent a Middle Eastern event happening here. You know, it's just terrible what's going on at present over there. We don't need that. We don't want it. We've got to allow, you know, other people to coexist with us on this continent here. And this is the most important part. Do we want that? No, we don't. We really are trying to ensure that everyone has a safe, peaceful life, you know. On the territory, this is the way Yidinji was. But when we stop and look at what the Australians have done and the British before have done to the Aboriginal people, it's been terrible. It's you know, yet they're still wanting to welcome people to country, you know, even though it's for a few dollars inside Australia, it's a pittance really what's owing to them. But we've got to be more grown up about that, and we've got to work out who we want to recognise us or work with us at international law to act for and on behalf of us at international law. But we still got to maintain our government that produces the legal identity that can be conferred, by the way, conferred to white fellas, not only Murrays, whitefellas as well, and this is the important part. Everyone inside Yidinji can have citizenship conferred upon them, but not at the tribal level. This is the important thing. Big distinction.
Absolutely, and that is controlled by the elders and the leaders of those individual clan groups inside the Yidinji society. That's a very important thing, Ganyar. Thanks you for mentioning that. If you are interested in Yidinji citizenship or nationality, go to homeaffairs.yidinji.org and you can learn a little bit more about what it takes to become a Yidinji national. You have to provide a police background check so we don't get crazy people here, because we've got enough crazy people already running the show, and we don't need any more. But seriously, you can I think Darragon Luma has done a very good job in that. You know, in the near future, we can have birth certificates, death certificates, ranging from many different things, permanent residencies, and all that kind of stuff. And that's all going digitally, by the way, working behind the scenes, which is an interesting segue to an article that the department wrote about the Yidinji Nation recently, and you can view that if you like. It'll be made available on the Yidinji website, but basically saying that the Yidinji Nation, which is a self-governing microstate, has taken an innovative approach to governance and technology, and it's capturing global attention. It talks about how the Yidinji Nation is making waves in a completely different arena, and that is the digital age. It talks about the current central bank digital currencies, the Yidinji computer operating system, and a few other exciting things that are happening on the territory that isn't happening anywhere else. And that's pretty exciting. Yirilam, I know that you constantly talk to the education types and you're actually using the Yidinji operating system in the office. And, you know, it's still in that particular version you have, it's still in a beta testing mode. But from what it does wonders for the nation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been a very special journey for the last few years that I've been here, witnessing the global partnerships that have contributed to Yidinji's position to be able to offer this sort of thing. And of course, you know, as you just mentioned, the Jubu operating system itself is from within Yidinji. It's our own citizens that have created this and are now sharing and using this model worldwide. And we continue to develop new and better things that actually are leading the planet, which I find is absolutely thrilling and amazing. And, of course, no coincidence in that happening. You know, it's the journey that the world needs to see and help the colonizers find a better way and the colonized to not be that way anymore.
Well, Gunyara, I know this. We talk about sovereignty a lot, but data sovereignty is potentially one of those ways where that unseen transfer or back to decolonization process can happen in at a real level, while on the face of things in the physical and material world, things still look the same. So I think that's a very good approach that Yidinji is taking, in that you know, it'll happen through the digital identities and other mechanisms that we're building here.
Look, data is the new currency of the world, believe it or not. Just like Australia has its own data, so do we. We have our own. We've got to look after it and protect it, of course, and utilise it for what it's really meant to be. So, look, the old legacy ledgers, you know, where you had a book with the birth of someone written down in it, and then you had the next ledger with the death of that person written down in it, that's all over and done with. It's gone. That happened many, many years ago. And as you know, the conferral of citizenship doesn't mean that it's compulsory. So what I say to all the Aboriginal nations, all those whose sovereignty still exists, by the way, get up, build your government and build your system. Now, it's so much easier than trying to have these thousands upon thousands of paper ledgers where everything is written down, data is everything. Now, this, the blockchain technology that we use, and it is there, it's there forever. Until the world is without electricity, that data is there. So it won't go away. Build it. It's so much easier. It's so much cheaper than having, you know, an office with 10,000 people in it to try and maintain these old ledgers that were never at any instant in time right up to date. Because, you know, you might have had the death ledger, birth, deaths and marriages. You got the death ledger. Someone had just passed away, you know, over on the other side of Australia. Was that ledger up to date? No, it wasn't until that death was ended. So at an instant in time, it's never up to date. But on the digital platform, this stuff can spread around the globe within, you know, the data can move within a split second.
Yeah, that's one of the exciting things. When we use our central bank digital currency, we transfer Yidinji dollars. It takes about 10 to 15 seconds, and that can be anywhere around the world. So that's exciting when we're talking about our central bank digital currency or our identity in data going places. You know, it's just building it now, so it's ready for that international cross-border experience where not only the Yidinji dollar will travel internationally, but the ID and everything else that is attached to it. I mean, this is more than 10 years in the making, but it's something that is at the hands of the indigenous tribes here on this continent that can be readily deployed.
17th of August 2017. Does that ring a bell, like when we kind of went to the big house down there and actually spoke in the big house to certain people of the Prime Minister's department, you know? We went down to offer them the things like visa, you know, how do you know who's who in which jurisdiction, you know? We said, we got the way for you to look at this now. You can instantaneously determine if we're in Yidinji jurisdiction or in Australia's jurisdiction. Which one is it? We can work with that. So, you know, seven years ago, we offered this remedy to them, which was the MOU towards a treaty. Let's work towards this, getting this stuff to happen. 7 years later, you know, we're ahead of Australia. I see just recently there was a mention of a small trial plot of running a blockchain or a QR code identity, real government identity. This is who you are, so you don't get your identity stolen. We've been offering this now for a while. Now, Yidinji's been running this for a number of years now, and it's been operating very well, very successful, because the blockchain technology is everything. Same with the Yidinji dollar. It's all online where everyone can see it, and there's no corruption involved in it.
Well, there you go. You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today. Thanks to our friends at Bumba Bipra Media, 98.7 FM. If you're listening inside the Commonwealth of Australia, it's via the National Indigenous Radio Service. A big hello to everyone who is taking this program. We love you and thank you for supporting the show. We'll be back after the break.
Hey, all, this is Baked Boy, and you're listening to Radio BBM 98.7 FM.
Well, we mentioned there about digital IDs and the way that Yidinji is moving forward. Earlier, I spoke to Gurul Argyll, the president of the Banagalbumba, which is the Yidinji court, and talking about how the jurisdiction can be used or artificial intelligence can assist with potentially looking at the application of justice and things inside the Yidinji territory. And I hope you enjoy this interview. Gurul, thanks for joining us. I'm just wondering now that the Yidinji Nation moving forward has a number of institutions in place, and through some of the excellent development programs that you've overseen, the Yidinji Nation can now source mediators. But that needs to obviously be increased in time. What other exciting developments can you see and opportunities for the Yidinji Nation to provide its citizens that space for remedy and other things that come to mind?
I think, first of all, just acknowledging the local elders, I want to say that part of my work has involved assisting the state of PNG to develop its mediation service under the National and Supreme Courts there. So working with a judge in PNG who was particularly interested in ADR, he and I went to the Solomon Islands High Court to help train them in mediation, and then we worked together in PNG to bring forward that mediation system by training magistrates and judges initially, and the court and the parliament making laws and regulations in relation to mediation. To me, that kind of process could be reproduced in the Yidinji realm, and we've already kicked off in the practical sense. That is, we've conducted a number of mediation training sessions. And probably the important observation about that, even though the qualification was designed in the Australian realm, it's recognised in the Yidinji realm, and we're offering accreditation in that space. But I do want to emphasise that people who have graduated from that realm, Indigenous folk, have been able to contribute enormous value to mediating matters outside of the Yidinji territory. So the system has shown to work in PNG, it works in Australia, and it will work in the Yidinji territory. So that's one component.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Obviously, that two-way learning that Dr. Yunupingu coined that phrase many years ago is the practical approach that the Unity Nation is taking. And it's wonderful to have someone of your expertise and knowledge and wisdom, in fact, that is obviously appreciated by elders here to move forward in this space, because the terms of the Western system, if we can call it that, there are practical benefits and there is some sort of international standard. Now, having Yidinji producing its own version of that is not only a challenge, but it's an exciting prospect, because we can really focus on what's working out there and have some sort of cultural application and sphere put into that model locally.
I think it's important that what we're doing is we're creating a standard here in the Yidinji Nation. So that's one point. The second point is that yes, it does reflect international standards, and yes, it and as does the Australian accreditation system. And so I don't think you can throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think you need to take some of the elements of the mainstream standard, the global standard, and bring that within the Yidinji system and use Yidinji meanings and influences to modify that stance so it's actually useful on the ground here. You can imagine that even the cultural differences between, say, France and the United States or Russia, you would have to take a different mediation approach. It's common in the mediation world to talk about the particular circumstance of Asia and how you might modify your mediation stance. So it's not a great leap, I don't think. It's fairly straightforward.
And I think we're in a good position with the leadership of the elders, because I would say there'd be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my guess would be that there would be a space for the administration or the contract law aspect of it, or citizens may want to opt in into a, let's say, what maybe people describe as an LORE type of environment, where there's a group of peers or elders in there to assist bring that potential conflict or dispute to a halt.
Yes. I guess there's, for me, there's several elements. One is LORE. Then there's a practical day-to-day space whereby people are in conflict and they need mediators, and that might involve people of different cultural backgrounds. So, for instance, in Gimoi, there is a large Papua New Guinean population, and it would seem to me to be appropriate to conduct mediation in Pidgin for that group. Similarly, in matters involving local Indigenous folk, you would need to take into consideration the meanings and kinship relations within that group. You can, so that's one aspect of how the mediation system here is being designed. We've gone with the practical first, train up some people, get some runs on the ground. The next part of the tribunal's evolution, I guess, is to formalise that space and decide which venue, for instance, a particular conflict might be best dealt with. So if it's got a very high level of LORE, it might not in fact be suitable for mediation, but need to be referred back to the elders for dealing with in some formal fashion. So a dispute over a burial might be mediation, or it might be law, or it might be some combination.
One of the things that I think would be very, very practical, you've mentioned that already, is that, yes, Yidinji have accredited mediators have helped outside in the other realm, but to use a baseball phrase, a pinch hitter, if there is let's say, a criminal matter that needs to be heard, not that we would want that at the moment, but we have to be prepared for those things, that's possibly where someone who has experience in criminal codes could interpret the Yidinji law to determine an outcome in a potential case that would be of a criminal nature.
Our recent discussions between yourself and the Attorney General, for instance, have involved the idea of, or at least canvassed my idea around bringing a magistrate from the Australian system to participate in the Adingee system. Importantly, to bring some rigour to the process, but also to bring some credibility. So that experience, even though it's in a different realm, is important. And in that discussion, I gave the example of in the 70s, after 1975 and Papua New Guinean independence, Australia provided magistrates who were appointed by the PNG system, but were able to immediately get runs on the board to make the system functional. And in my head, there's a similar kind of idea here. We might need to, hold a first step, which might be a gathering of people who have something to say, who've got some runs on the board in the space, who perhaps are academics and might be able to give us some higher-level thought about how to set up a system. And then a next stage would be to enact a system, and that's where I see these experienced people dropping in. And then ultimately we would create our own system with its own regulations and laws and be able to develop that. I still think, and perhaps controversially, that some elements of LAW should perhaps be shared with the Australian state rather than Yidingi trying to reinvent that wheel.
Well, I think that we're talking about practical things. And while it might be the intention of a Yidingi citizen to become a magistrate, we're not there yet. So to like I said, to use that existing resource out there is important. Now, one of the ideas that we have in terms of the private international law space, which is what Yidingi is, and the extraterritorial sovereignty, the Yidingi space could also act as an international peace court to maybe provide a space, a neutral space, for any potential conflict of law between UN member states, for example, or a dispute resolution regarding international companies that really want to look at and support something that's a lot more, let's say, neutral, because obviously UN member states all are connected. And that may be an option in the future for tribes that do come back with their legal entities, their governments, for example, that want to not hear their own matter, for example.
I think at the moment I'm more in the camp of trying to get towards that space of there being a Yidingi international court. Before then, I think it's achievable that we could create an international dispute resolution space. So in the same way that countries are signing up to the Singapore Convention around arbitration mediation, it might be that there's a Yidingi Convention on mediation, which invites not only countries in dispute, but indigenous communities who might be in dispute with their country, in the sense of, not in a Yidingi sense, but in the sense of, say, another Australian indigenous group who haven't asserted sovereignty but have a dispute with the state. One of the things around the Pacific at the moment is climate change adds to conflict. Indigenous communities are intimately connected to resources and country, and climate change is creating issues for them. And those conflicts can be potentially mediated on neutral ground here in Gimoi under the auspices of an international mediation system and a Yidingi international mediation forum court.
Absolutely, and then these are aspirations. Obviously, we don't want to build it tomorrow, but we'd love that if it happened. But obviously, there is a very important process.
I want to interrupt. I think what's important is that these institutions exist already. We're not inventing a new thing. The Singapore Convention exists. At the beginning of that, the comments were, it'll never work. I think the fact that these things already exist, so there's a thing we can model ourselves on, that we have witnessed the development of PNG. I think that's a very good example because it seems analogous to me between Yidinji Nation and PNG Nation and its development pathway. So while they're aspirations, they have a realistic element to them.
Yeah, and this is what I think where Yidinji is leading that way because it is about security of personality, security of tenure. I think, in my view, at least, and of the nation, that this is a frictionless cross-border space where peace, order and good government is the philosophy that's expressed most sincerely here. And I wanted to take you on a little journey down the track into the future because and these are hypothetical things, but how do you see in the future, let's say the Yidinji was to create a digital space to have some sort of, what we're talking about now, some sort of digital space to hear matters where, crypto laws and things of that nature can be very difficult because there might be a conflict of law where party A might say, well, it was the citizen that you initiated by using our money. The citizen might say, well, that digital asset is on a server on a third party or another nation. So it can become a bit confusing there. How do you see that Yidinji making efforts to go down that space and how, using your future outlook, how could we come up with something that would maybe remedy that situation?
Well, again, it's practical. Yidinji didn't invent digital currencies. They didn't invent, other people have done it. Other countries have done it. It already exists. So the problem pre-exists the Yidinji version of it. And I think clearly there are going to be answers that other people have tried and failed or tried and succeeded sort of or tried and succeeded very well. And so my suggestion would be Yidinji shops around and gets the best possible model to enable it. In the digital space, going back to the previous issue, digital platforms can be very helpful in a practical sense. So if you've got a low-key legal matter, criminal matter under a certain value, perhaps AI in a digital space could enable a quick and efficient resolution that delivers justice. There's a saying among lawyers that justice delayed is justice denied, and one of the common problems across the planet is the timing, is the lack of immediacy around justice. Similarly, a mediation platform that dealt with potentially less complex matters could be important in speeding things up. These things would obviously throw out into the human space matters that came into particular conflicts. You could design it so that it did that.
And this is the challenge, obviously, that we do have, because even now I know that the Commonwealth Secretariat is looking at these types of issues, for example. Mm. But, what would that space look like? Is it Yidinji Common Law? Is it Rome 1, Rome 2? Is it International Convention? Or is it some sort of other law that would regulate that jurisdiction or that parties would agree to enter into that space, for example? I mean, I'm putting you on the spot here. I do apologise.
I think the method that I've seen elsewhere is there's an international convention that sets a standard, right? Through pain and suffering, the planet has come up with rules that it says are really, really important fundamentally. So the Dresden firestorm in World War II meant that the UN convention says you can't use weapons of mass destruction. And in particular, you can't design a war system that creates a city-wide inferno. It's completely illegal. So if you have a system with that in place, then your local laws can reflect those standards, keeping in mind that the standards shift. So they're gonna change. I imagine the Palestine-Israel conflict, the Ukraine-Russia conflict will lead to another series of innovation in our international laws. And in my view, I think the Yidinji nation and its legal development should reflect the best of those conversations and changes. There is an enormous problem in Australia around the high percentage of Indigenous people in the justice system. It seems completely inappropriate. There is no practical reason for that to occur. It costs money, it takes time, it occupies the police force, it occupies the judicial system. They're all practical reasons. In more human terms, it creates pain in families and in individuals that is completely unnecessary. I think that what we need to be careful about is how we design a system so that we don't have unintentional consequences. So the application of law inappropriately to a particular group results in awful consequences. People have argued that it is intentional. I don't think we need to go there. I think we just need to look at the fact and say, well, we don't want that. Let's have something else. How would we get to something else?
And this is why we spoke earlier about, is it an LORE to opt into that space, or is it through contract law, through the citizenship, for example, or the written law and the laws that citizens should uphold? You brought up a very, very good point there, and I wanted to sort of just quickly elaborate on that about unintended consequences. In terms of, once again, putting on your future thinking hat, how can we stop AI from being biased, or how does AI reflect cultural values of the Yidinji Nation, for example?
I was recently involved in a conversation with an Indigenous person about a database that's used to manage mediation.
And that was Gurul Argyle, the president of the Yidinji Court. You're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet. We'll be back after the break with some final comments.
Hey everyone out there, my name's Benny Hodges. I live in Canberra, but I'm back home, and every time I'm here, the only station I listen to is BBM. So say Geronimo,
say Geronimo, say Geronimo. Well, that's it. I think this is the last program for the year from us. Yirrlum, some final comments.
Yeah, no, just best wishes to everybody. Have a great new year, and we're looking forward to another big one out there. And I think, you know, as always, the one that stuck with me out of this today's transmission is choice. You know, you've got an ability to choose other than just an Australian ID, so you can choose your jurisdiction. So hey, step up and create it, and we'll help out.
Well, free will is a wonderful thing. And Ganyara, your closing comments?
As you hear about the Yidinji Court, you got to understand that we wouldn't be breaking new ground in this respect. If you go into some of the Middle Eastern countries, you'll find that there are various courts at different levels. Like in Syria, for example, there were Christian courts. You know, this is religious-based courts. There was the Sunni courts. So it was all based on your belief and your religion as to what court you were heard in. And this one here, you know, the Yidinji Court is all about legislation, about who we are, how we can interpret our law once it's being challenged. But look, it is a big task, I tell you now. It's not an easy one. And then, you know, the team have earned a well-earned break here. So we're going to wind down for the rest of the year, just slow down on the other stuff. But my department is a bit flat out. We're rewriting the position paper at present. That will come out next year.
Sounds very exciting.
Well, I want to see the rest of the world challenge it, you know, to say that we don't exist, that we're not one of the coexisting sovereignties that coexist with Australia. You know, it's a big task, but we're doing it for the world to understand who we are.
I guess pushing the Yidinji vehicle, we're trying to push start it, and it's slow to get...